together on this 3rd of July, 2023. It's the eve of a big holiday here in the United States. I'll speak to that a tiny bit. And for those who I may have not met yet, it's good to meet you. I use he and him pronouns, and I am in Northern California, about an hour north of the Spirit Rock land, in what's now Western Sonoma County. This is the ancestral lands of the Southern Pomo peoples, and it's a beautiful summer evening here. So sending blessings from the California coast to wherever you are. We will begin tonight, as always on Monday nights, with a meditation. I'll give some instruction in the beginning of the meditation around mindfulness in relation to the six senses. And then we'll sit in silence for the remainder of the time. I'll end with the meditation with a short chant, and I'll share the words to that when we get there. We'll then have a short break, as we always do. We'll come back for a talk, and I'll speak a bit tonight around independence, liberation, enlightenment, and weave through some connected or perhaps tangled threads in that direction, in honor or resistance or a bit of both to this holiday. But first, we'll sit together. So come to a comfortable posture for meditation in stillness. When I say sit here, really, I mean that we'll come into stillness, and that for many of us might be sitting, but for others, if it's right for your body, that could be lying down or standing up. Sitting can be on a chair or cushion or bench or other support. We're going for a posture that is stable and comfortable as much as possible, and that it's stable and comfortable enough that we can really be still. And of course, that's an ideal, not a goal, perhaps. So there's always some movement in the body. That's part of what we notice when we notice change or impermanence. But we bring the body towards some stillness in order to more clearly perceive the turning world around us and the play of the senses. So coming to something like stillness, if you're sitting, letting the lower body feel its contact with the earth, the sense of stability through gravity, the feeling of contact, the sensations of pressure and weight, solidness. Sometimes the more clearly we can feel the lower body rooted, the more clearly we start to feel the upper body as light, and not straining so much to maintain the upright posture, but finding a kind of balanced poise or dignity with the sense of a bit of uplift through the chest and sternum. As best we can, relaxing through the face and jaw, and the back of the neck and shoulders, down through the arms. And if it feels good, a few full in and out breaths can help land us in the here and now. Letting go of whatever we've been doing, heading into this moment, into this practice together. As we have a sense of the body and the breath and the attention beginning to arrive here, the sense of bodily life, the life of the somatic, alive physicality of our life can really come forward. As the body settles in stillness, you might feel the momentum of activity through the day, and there might be some restlessness. Or you might feel the effect of everything you've been doing, and there might be some sleepiness or dullness. And of course, the mind as well can be racing ahead or dragging along sluggishly. We'll bring our attention to the six senses, the five physical senses, and the heart mind, one at a time, practicing connecting with them, feeling them in an embodied way, and letting them be. And this is a beautiful foundation for deepening in concentration, and it is an insight practice itself as we come to understand the body in its aliveness. And the quality of change or impermanence that as Joanna Macy and Anita Barrows say in their translation of Rilke, is the very fragrance of our days. Impermanence, the very fragrance of our days. We'll begin with perhaps one of the more obvious and difficult of the senses, but also one that can really help us feel grounded as we begin our practice, which is the sense of sight or seeing. And so if your eyes have been closed, I'll encourage you to open them for a moment here and let your gaze move around the space you're in. And just see the room, if it's a room, or the space outside, if you're outside. You can let your gaze turn your head. Just see. And there can be the sense of knowing where you are. Seeing, we become oriented in space. This can itself be calming and grounding. And if you notice something in the space that you like, or that's interesting or good looking to you, has a little ping of pleasure, let your gaze rest there and just take in this little flicker of beauty or interest. And as you do, continue to settle the body, relaxing, breathing. And then you can let the gaze just be soft and open, settled. You could do the whole meditation with eyes open, with eyes resting gently downward. Sometimes this can really help with distraction. But letting the gaze soften, we can shift into the mode of insight, and rather than thinking about what it is we're seeing, just notice that we are seeing. And you could say the word to yourself softly, seeing, seeing. So you really just become aware of the act of seeing. It happens by itself when the eyes are open and working enough to give you an image. If you happen to be vision impaired or blind, you can let the eyes be open and see whatever color or light arrives. Or you could even let the eyes be closed and tune into the inner seeing, the imaginative eye. For every kind of seeing, there's the consciousness of image. And so we can just be aware of seeing. So much story and clinging and craving comes through seeing. Seeing things we want more of, seeing things we're afraid of. And so our first gesture here is to notice that there's just seeing. And then to set it down. And what does that mean? I think partly it means having the intention to not get involved, to not get involved in the story about a thing, but just let it be. So we don't need to do anything with anything we're seeing. See if you can sense this little turn toward putting it down, a little non-involvement. It's almost like if you are seeing something beautiful, you don't need to own it. And if you're seeing something broken, you don't need to fix it right now. If you're seeing something you want, you can be mindful of that want, but you don't need to act on that right now. So there can be seeing without action. Sensing into this, see if you can drop a little further into stillness as you let go of grasping at what is seen. And playing with that for a moment. And now that you have a sense of that process, we'll do the same with each of the other senses a little more briefly. Tuning into hearing. Begin to listen. Directing attention to sounds as they come and go. Notice how sounds appear and disappear by themselves in the space around the body. Notice any tendency to grasp or hook into a sound that's happening. Maybe following the sound to see what happens with it, or listening to words if somebody is speaking nearby. And again, the gesture here is to understand hearing. This is hearing. Hearing is happening. And then to set it down, to not grasp, to not spin a story. Whatever's happening that's coming in through the door of the ear, through the hearing, we don't need to do anything about it right now. Noticing what it feels like to let sounds come and go while you sit back, knowing them without needing to do anything, and see if this can deepen the sense of stillness and ease. Turn attention to smelling. Notice if there's any smells. Notice if they have any content or reaction, any grasping or aversion to any smell that might be coming in. I'm just recognizing this is smelling. Smelling is happening. And letting go of needing to do anything about a smell. We rest in mindful awareness of smell. And deepen in stillness. Tasting. Noticing any tastes that are present. Aware of the activity of tasting. Tasting is happening. Aware of any grasping or aversion, any story around tasting. And setting it down, being willing to be present with any tastes, and not needing to do anything about them. And then we'll turn to one of the other more complex or challenging senses, which is sensation itself through the whole body, the sense of temperature, pressure, vibration, contact. Here's where our stories about comfort and discomfort, ability and disability, pain and pleasure, posture, strength, weakness, all of this moves through the bodily sensation. Sense. And this is also one of the richest places for deepening in embodiment, grounding. Tuning into the whole body. And it can be helpful here to feel the whole body of sensation all at once. It can be a deep habit for the attention to only go to places that are uncomfortable, but very helpful to hold discomfort in the context of the whole body, which is almost always a mix of comfort and discomfort. And it can be integrating to feel the whole body all at once. You might do a quick or simple body scan here to stitch the body together, feeling the head and neck, shoulders, arms, and hands, upper chest, lower chest, belly, hips and pelvis, and the legs, upper legs and lower legs down to the feet. So you can feel the whole field of the body, breathing, sensing, awake. Here, the temptation, the habit can be strong to grasp at pleasurable sensations and fear or dislike or worry about unpleasant ones. As best you can, see if you can hold the whole sensate body in awareness and set down doing anything about it for the moment. Letting there be pleasure and pain both. If pain is very strong, it can be often skillful to move, to adjust the body, and then to resettle into stillness. And the practice here is not to hurt the body by ignoring it, but to learn how to not be on a short leash, always running around after every discomfort and every pleasure. Can we let the body be just as it is and deepen in stillness and ease, no matter what's happening? Play with this. Deepening or calming the breath can help here. And the last of the classical senses is the heart-mind, what we could call the emotional and cognitive centers. This is all of the energetic, emotional, narrative parts of our experience, the information parts. And an easy doorway to this is just to notice your mood, which is going to be a combination of physical sensation and energy and emotional energy, sometimes story, the way that our mood is affected by what's happening in our life, and what we think, what we say, and what other people say. And what's been happening around us. Noticing the mood, you get a sense of your state. And again, here, can you notice? You could just name it feeling. Feeling. Feeling is happening. In the body, sensing is happening. In the heart and mind, feeling is happening. Or thinking, if there's a lot of story going on, thinking is happening. And then how do we let go? How do you let things be? Thoughts usually stop once you notice them. But your mood often doesn't. And so it's a good place to practice. Notice the mood and let it be. If you're grumpy, be grumpy. If you're excited, be excited. If you're peaceful, be peaceful. But there can be a knowing of it in the same way that you know what your room looks like or what sounds are happening. or how your back feels. You can know how your heart feels. And set down the intention, the need to do anything about it for now. And just let it be. And as we let it be, there's a deepening into stillness, no matter what mood we're in. So this is our practice with the senses. You can continue to work with any of them that call to you, or just rest in stillness with breath, the sense of the whole body, feeling into non-involvement with the senses, letting all the senses and the heart-mind just be. And so you're aware of what's happening without getting involved. And see if you can feel the sweetness and the pleasure in that space. And so we'll sit in silence the rest of the time together. We'll finish our meditation with a short chant. I'll chant three times, a chant known as the homage to the Buddha. There it is in the chat, if you want to sing along, many of you will know this. This honors the Buddha as the blessed one, the perfected one, the fully awakened one. I'll sing it three times in Pali. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammā sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammā sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammā sambuddhassa. All right, letting it go. Welcome to folks who came in while we were sitting, meditating. We'll take a short break here we'll take about 8 minutes, come back at 5 after the hour. Blessings as you refresh the body, and we'll rejoin in just a little bit. See you soon. All right, welcome back. Good to see you folks. Just a moment to welcome Sangha from all over, from wherever you are. If you'd like to drop into the chat any bit of hello, where you are in the world, so that we can recognize you, see you, celebrate you. That's great. Please do that. And Ileana has dropped into the chat also some links to upcoming programs. So have a look at those as well. So welcoming folks from various parts of the west coast of North America, folks in Petaluma, Sebastopol, that's right around the corner from me here, from Oregon up north, blessings in Chicago, blessings down deep south in Melbourne. Good to have you in your deep winter time. Blessings to folks from Seattle, Port Townsend, welcome. Mill Valley, San Francisco, local folks, local and far away. Great to have you. So as I said, for anyone who came in during the meditation, welcome. I'm Sean Oakes. I use he and him. I'm up in Sonoma County, just a bit north of the Spirit Rock land. And welcome to folks who are new here. Welcome to Spirit Rock in its online format. Really good to have you. I'm going to speak tonight a little bit about I'm thinking about this word independence, since it is quote unquote Independence Day. It's Independence Day Eve here in the United States. Some reflections on this word, which is an important concept in the Buddha's teachings. So I'll talk for a bit and then we'll have some time for discussion. As Ileana said in the beginning, if you are open to having your video on, it's great to have the felt sense of a room full of active listeners here. It's helpful for me to be able to see your smiles, your frowns, your reactions. You know, I don't know if a joke lands unless I can see you. So if you feel like that's an easy thing for you to do, please do that. You can always, of course, continue with your camera off if that's what's right for you. So I'm not going to talk a lot about the United States or politics, partly because we are a global sangha, and this is not everyone's Independence Day. And even here in the US, it's not everyone's Independence Day. But that is the formal name of the holiday that we put on the 4th of July, which is when a bunch of folks in 1776 declared independence from the King of England, from King George III, the Mad King, and began a war for independence on this continent, which would lead to the U.S. becoming a country rather than a colony dependent on England. Of course, the presence of those settlers here was itself an act of settlement and colonialism, a colonial project. Of course, this continent was filled with nations already and peoples, many, many thousands of peoples in many hundreds of different nation states and language groups and tribal groups. And the arrival of the European settlers on this continent was complex, but in many cases was brutal and disastrous for those who were here before and who in many cases are still here trying to recover from that process and invasion. And so So for many of us here in the States who have become awake to the effects of the colonial process, this is a complex holiday at least, and for some very much not celebratory. It's also the case that many folks coming here from Europe, from England, were themselves oppressed and escaping tyranny. And so the sense of there being an independence here is real. And there was independence for those oppressed folks from England. And I say this partly as a form of land acknowledgement and acknowledgement of the complexity of the holiday here, and you know, variations on this tragedy and complexity exist all around the world, everywhere that European colonialism touched, which is almost every nation on the planet. And I'll use this as the starting off point to weave back toward the Dharma, because we can see that this thing that we might call independence in this, taking this particular historical socio-political example, you know, refugees from England and other places coming to a new continent, and in the process of themselves settling here, enacting what would become a terrible genocide of other peoples, we could see that on a planet that has always been filled with people, ever since humans spread out, there have been groups of people everywhere, that for one group of people to go to another place and make a new home there displaces those who were there already. At the very least, alters their life irrevocably. And so independence is never clean or separate from conditions. So perhaps it's possible to simultaneously hold in our hearts that it was appropriate for one group of oppressed peoples to flee Europe and try to find safety elsewhere. And at the same time, that attempt to find safety and a better life elsewhere gave rise to tremendous suffering and violence. And so independence turned out to be not as clear or clean or virtuous as we might wish it to be. And that's because from the perspective of the Dharma, it's not real independence. And so thinking about the Buddha's teaching, we can see an orientation toward suffering and living in the world and the use of resources that points to something that might be truly called independence, that does not result in the degradation of others or the taking of resources from others. In the early texts of the Buddhist tradition gathered in the Pali Canon, there's a line that that often would stand out to me. And it's a line that's part of the stock phrase that is used in the text to describe a person who has had an insight, generally the insight into impermanence, that has opened their Dharma eye, that has opened them to the truth of the way things are. And they have entered the stream, is what it's called. They have become one who has integrated the Dharma, the teachings, in their own being. And they are now firmly established on the path to liberation. Stream entry is the first of four levels or unfoldings of liberation. But once it happens, full liberation is guaranteed, traditionally within seven lifetimes, often much sooner. Because once you have broken through to that initial clarity, in a certain way, it's all details from there. And there's a lot of details. It's not, there's some distance between stream entry and full liberation, but it's guaranteed. And so the thing to get to is stream entry. That's the thing to really strive for. And the early texts, just to say as an aside, fully endorse striving for stream entry. Now, paradoxically, deep acceptance is the way to get there, but you have to strive to get there. Isn't that a great paradox? That's lovely. It's tremendously important to become liberated. It takes work, but the work is relaxing and letting go. So when people would realize this first opening to truth, there's a string of things that are said to describe them. And one of them is that they have become, quote, independent of others in the teacher's dispensation. That means in the body of the teachings or in the community of the Dharma. Independent of others. So part of what stream entry means is that you have seen the Dharma for yourself. And having seen it for yourself, no one can take it away from you. No one can convince you otherwise. The cornerstone insight that leads to stream entry is the insight into impermanence. And so part of that stock phrase that describes the when someone gets opens their Dharma eye or becomes liberated in this first stage is they often exclaim, everything that has a beginning has an end. Everything that has the conditions to arise has the conditions to pass away. And this is the way the early texts phrase the insight into impermanence. It's a way of saying, oh, I can see that everything I grasp at or even might grasp at is temporary. It came into being based in conditions and it will change and dissolve, disappear. It will be lost from me based in conditions. If you see this, the idea is everything unfolds from there in the direction of freedom, right? If I understand that nothing lasts, that is meant to signal, I think, very deeply to the heart that grasping is pointless. And when the heart understands that grasping is pointless, it lets go. Now, this is not so easily done, even though the texts make it seem obvious, like, oh, I saw impermanence. Now I've entered the stream and I realize nothing is ever truly mine. You know, it takes some doing to really integrate that insight into wisdom. But based on that insight, one becomes independent of others. There's a beautiful word in the chant that describes the Dhamma, the qualities of the Dhamma or the Dharma. And that word is ehipasiko, ehipasiko. It means come and see for yourself. Or the Dharma is to be seen by the wise for themselves. This is a concept that is completely central in the Buddha's teachings. Other people, wise friends, good teachers, texts, the tradition, lineages, can point the way, but they can't take you there. So I can tell you everything that has the conditions to arise, has the conditions to pass away, and you can be like, yeah, 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 I totally believe you, and not be transformed. That happens all the time, right? You've heard this Dharma talk before, variations of it. Have you entered the stream? If you haven't, why? Because it hasn't penetrated fully. And that's true for all of us, right? That the habits that take form as grasping and clinging, they are very, very deep. They are as deep as the desire to stay alive, which is one of their most fundamental manifestations, right? That eventually also has to be seen. Oh, everything that arises passes away. That means us, right? Right now, I'm in the liminal space immediately following my father's passing away. And so if I ever had the idea that a parent was permanent, and of course, I can't remember not knowing that death was real. Like, I can't remember what it might have been like to be a tiny child before I encountered loss. But even knowing that death is real for everyone, do you really get it? You know, do you really know in your bones that your parent or your cat or yourself or your best friend or your lover or your partner or your child will die? Do we really get it? Stream entry partly means we really get it. And really getting it doesn't mean I stop loving. It actually means I can love more because I'm not deluded about what's happening. There's not the same kind of attachment. And so this word, come and see for yourself, ehipasiko, means that no one can tell you enough to give you insight. But your own heart, when it sees clearly, when it investigates reality based on the teachings, it can come to this extraordinary insight. And then once it does, no one can convince you otherwise. No one can pull you off the path. And you could even have that insight and forget for a while. It will reemerge. It will come back. If there's really what's called stream entry, if there's really having become independent of others in the body of the teachings, then independence really means I'm not dependent on someone else for this knowledge, this wisdom. I'm not looking to a priest or a monk or a nun or a wise elder to own the knowledge. The knowledge is in me. And so this is a beautiful arrival that we work toward. One of the things that's often said about the teachings, the Dhamma, is that they are beautiful in the beginning, beautiful in the middle, and beautiful in the end. And so talking about stream entry and this kind of profound insight, this is perhaps a version of beautiful at the end, or at least beautiful in the advanced middle, something like that, of the path. A lot of us, maybe that feels a little foreign. We're back at what we might call the beginning, or the advanced beginning, or the middle beginning, or the beginning, you know, somewhere in there. And so what is it about this independence that we might be able to see for the beginning and the middle of the path? One of the beautiful things about the Buddha's teaching is that very often the insight that marks the end of a part of the path is very similar to the practice that gets you there. And so if the insight is everything arises and passes, and therefore I can let go, I don't have to cling, the practice that gets you there is explore how everything arises and passes. Explore permanence. Explore things, which really means experiences, very deeply. How do we explore things very deeply? Right? We do it through mindfulness, through concentration, through investigation, through inquiry. And so one of the ways to notice impermanence is to notice it in the world around you and your own body through the medium of the senses. And so this is often how the methods of meditation work, is they say, tune into some aspect of the sensory world. Maybe you tune into the sensations of the breath rising and falling, or you tune into sounds coming and going in space around you. Or as you're moving, you tune into the movement of the legs while walking, or the movement of the arms as you reach for something and pick it up and bring it back. Maybe you tune into how you look around and you see, when I look that way, I see that. When I look that way, I see that. When I close my eyes, it disappears. When I open my eyes, it's all a little different. So you tune into the senses. And the senses, as we looked at in the meditation, are traditionally six. Five physical senses: seeing, hearing, smelling, tasting, touching. And the cognitive emotional sense. And in the Dharma, those are combined into one thing, because it's really hard to parse the difference between a thought and a feeling. And so they're so often merged. And so the cognitive emotional is the sixth sense, the sense of the heart and mind. And so with mindfulness, we tune into any one of these, or we rest in a kind of open awareness and we watch them, all of them flicker and play. And what we'll see if we are really attentive is we see change. You see sensations come and go, sometimes pleasant, sometimes unpleasant, sometimes neutral. You see the world around you change. I can see the leaves on the tree outside waving in the, presumably from the wind. I can hear sounds near me fluctuating. I can tune into sensations in my body and they're changing. I can tune into even subtler sensation and feel the waves of the breath and energy, or even subtler sensation and feel vibration and tingling and pressure and the hum of the body. I can tune into the emotional sense and feel my mood and how it's affected by what's been happening for me lately, and how my mood is affected by sensation and affects sensation and how those weave together. No matter what I tune into, as it turns out, in this realm of the senses, what I find is change. And so a common inquiry might be noticing that. What happens? How does that feel to notice change? Do I find something that feels like an anchor and I really want to hold on to it? So maybe I notice that my feelings are really changing all the time, and so I want to identify with something more solid than that. And so I just feel the body, or I feel the earth. And I say the earth is permanent. This is usually unconscious. So I'm going to feel grounded, and I'm going to stabilize by tuning into that. That's often really skillful practice, by the way, right? But as I do that, maybe I keep inquiring, and then I notice that my sense of the solidness of the earth actually comes and goes. Sometimes I can really feel it, sometimes I can't. And of course, I live in California, so every once in a while, the earth isn't solid at all. And it does this frightening thing, and it rolls like waves of water across the field. The first time I saw that, it was really weird. The earth rolling like water, not as solid as I had imagined I could trust. So we practice observing, and we observe until the way things work is so obvious to us that no one could convince us otherwise. This is an observational practice. That's why wisdom is the result. And so the practice then of observing through the senses and inquiring, it leads to a kind of independence from the objects of the senses, right? If I've observed around me and I've noticed that the objects in my space, they come and go. You know, I know who gave me that painting, and I know how old it is. And so I know that there was a time I didn't have it. And I know what happens to paintings. I've seen old paintings. One day it will not be as intact as it is now. And long before that, I might lose it or give it away or sell it, or it might get broken, or I don't know. I have a kid splashed with ketchup. Who knows, right? Its current state is unreliable. And I'm mature enough to know that that's true about all of my precious things, right? The beautiful rock that someone gave, that an attractive hippie gave to me once on a beach, It's in a bowl over there. And I noticed the other day that I'd forgotten who gave it to me and why. And so what does it mean at that point? At one point, it held a story, and now the story has faded away. Blessings to that person, you know? But there was a while when I had about 40 rocks like that from various parties and events, you know, hippies carrying rocks around in our pockets. They've changed, but everything changes. And so if I really get this, what does this do to my sense of like how I am with the things around me? You know, I cling to them a little less. Every once in a while, I go through the rocks and I'm like, well, let's just put these in the garden. You know, the chi has moved on. It's great. You know, over there is my childhood teddy bear because, you know, he's still here. I tried to give him to my kid, but my kid wasn't that interested. So now he's here with me. So I'll save it maybe for another 30 years and see if I live that long, see if I can give it to a grandkid if one appears. But at some point, it's going to go where teddy bears go, you know, to the teddy bear's picnic in the sky, I suppose, or in the woods, really. That song totally freaked me out when I was a kid. Ominous teddy bears gathering in the woods. Don't go alone, it said. So independent from the senses means that the automatic hook of craving, which is usually story, identity, meaning, belonging, ownership, that hook has become softened through the understanding of impermanence. So, you know, I'm really fond of the teddy bear. His name is Cinnamon because of his color. But if he got lost, or if I gave him to someone who moved across the country and I never saw him again, you know, I'd be okay, right? I can love without holding on because I understand something. Now, like, sure, it's easy enough for the teddy bear. It would be a little bit more difficult with the cello. It would be quite a bit more difficult with the child himself. But that's the practice, isn't it? To really understand with our whole heart that everything is subject to the laws of nature, to the unfolding in the ecosystem, right? Everything goes back to compost. Right now, my father's body is in the process of becoming ash. And a week ago, I was holding his hand. And all the feelings are appropriate. But where there is clinging, where there is the clench of resistance to what is, there will be suffering. And it's completely possible to love and delight in and be humanly attached to and grieve the loss of good things while still practicing this deep letting go. The Buddha really loved his disciples. And he had two lead disciples, Sariputta and Mahamoggallana, who were with him from close to the early days of his ministry. And that meant they spent much of their lives together until they were these three old men leading of this vast, beautiful community. There were elderly men and women in the monastic and in the sanghas of men and women. And the Buddha was very fond of them, really loved them. The leader of the women's sangha was his own stepmother, Mahapajapati, the sister of his mother who raised him. And when his two chief disciples, Sariputta and Moggallana, died just a little bit before him, he did a Dharma talk in which he said to the assembled monastics, he said, "Monks, the Sangha feels empty. Something is missing. Sariputta and Moggallana were so beautiful, so good. You know, you can really like it's phrased in the slightly formal language of the early texts, but you can really just feel him saying, you know, I love them. They were my friends. I miss them. He really says, you know, I miss them. The Sangha is empty without them, you know? And such warmth of heart, right? No warmth is absent in the Buddha. You can tell such kindness. He never becomes kind of cool or distant or formal. When the Buddha's lying on his deathbed, you know, and everyone's gathered around, he's no longer getting up, he's dying of food poisoning, he's laying in the forest in a tiny town called Kusinara, underneath a pair of twin sal trees that burst into blossom unseasonably in order to decorate him with flowers as he lays there. And he stays alive long enough for monks and nuns and lay people to come from all over and gather around, and deities from all over the cosmos come and gather around. There's this huge crowd there meditating with him, watching him as he slowly passes. And one of the final things he says is, you know, that he's not going to appoint a human successor. And he says, monastics, be a lamp unto yourself. Be independent, he says, you know. Let the Dhamma be your guide. Let the teachings be your guide. When you're unsure of what way to go, trust the teachings. I've given you, you know, I've given you the teachings for 45 years. I've taught you without a closed fist. I have not held anything back. Remember the teachings, trust them, trust each other, and trust those who remember the teachings. And he didn't establish a guru tradition. He didn't say, and this person is the next leader of the Sangha. He said, now be independent. Be independent and trust what is true. And then as he was about to die, a new person came up, like a random bystander came by who was kind of like, what's with all the crowds? I heard there was a dying saint. And the monks are like, go away, go away. Like, it's a really important moment. The Buddha's dying. And this guy's like, I kind of just have a question. And they're like, this is not the time. And the Buddha says to the monks, let him pass, let him pass. Let him come and ask his question. And this person comes and asks a really basic Dharma question, like not very deep. The Buddha gives a direct answer. The person loves the answer, asks for the admission to the Sangha to become a monk. The Buddha gives the admission. And that person becomes the last direct disciple, the last person directly ordained by the Buddha. In the very last moment, he's just generous and warm and open. And so in independence from the senses, what we land in is a way of being that doesn't take from or demand anything of the world around us. Right? And this doesn't mean a kind of emotional isolation. You know, this isn't a sort of stoic, masculine, you know, I depend on no one. Right? The Buddha said, you know, depend on each other. Right? The Buddha said having good friends is the whole of the holy life. But the Dhamma, the teachings that liberate, are to be seen by each person themselves. You must see it for yourself and become independent of others in terms of the teachings. And so we have this beautiful system where socially and economically, there's a communal nature to Dharma practice. We are meant to be together, to rely on each other. The Buddha's biggest material creation was the Sangha, was this vast intentional community of people willing to live collectively, to share resources, to not oppress others in order to get their resources. Begging for food is a way to use both as little resources as possible and to not drain the resources of others. And then the independence of insight and wisdom deepens this by taking nothing from anyone else and finding the way that the human heart can be deeply happy and at peace, at ease in the world, in a way that doesn't take from anyone else. And this is the thing that's lost in the political independence of a certain body of people from a state, the independence gained in a revolution, is in the political world, in the material world, there are limited resources on our beautiful blue-green planet here. And so one group of people claiming independence often just means claiming some amount of resources for their own and putting a wall around it, a wall of money or legality or power or border. There is no political independence. There is no economic independence. Everyone on the planet is connected to everyone else. And there was never any wide open land for the taking. Anthropologists have even proposed that when the earliest humans landed in new places, like on the continent of Australia for the first time, within a very short period of time, they decimated the great fauna, the enormous animals of that place, that there were huge marsupials that became extinct. And that, you know, wherever a species goes that is new to it, we see this with invasive species all the time. It's true in my backyard with English ivy and Mongolian blackberry. We see an imbalance and a taking too much, or at least a taking so much that it looks like imbalance. It's hard for me to judge without knowing everything about the ecosystem, but it looks like the ivy is behaving badly from all that I understand about the redwood ecosystem. And it certainly looks, from what I understand about the North American social ecosystem, that the refugees from Europe and England became an unbalancing force here. And the same with the Spanish further south through Mexico and Central and South America. Those two groups, my ancestors. So I have just a prayer for the resolution of that ancient karma and the moving of our globe toward a more equitable, sustainable, ecologically sound, socially sound world, guided by principles that are more like the Dharma, where we take only what we need and we don't demand that which is the land or purview of someone else. This, I think, is what the independence of the Buddha can point us toward. Because we go from the beginning of noticing the play of the senses, letting them be, and learning to rest in relation to them. The result of that is going to be less grasping, less greed, less clinging. And that's going to mean, in a very material sense, less resource hoarding, less constriction around our privileges, more giving. It's not random that the first of the practices and the first of the perfections is giving, dana. Giving dana doesn't mean, please give us some donations at the end of the Dharma talk, although please do, if you are so moved. Giving is a perfection of the heart that is one of the first steps on the direct path to this deep independence and liberation, because it teaches the heart to let go. It teaches us to let go of that which we traditionally grasp onto so hard: money, resources, time, energy. And so independence from the senses, not being pushed around by the pleasant and the unpleasant and the grasping and aversion that comes with that, leads to time. It leads to relaxing. It leads to being good with less. And this unfolds further. It's like there's a spiral of seeing clearly and letting go, seeing more clearly, letting go more, seeing more clearly, letting go more. Like that beautiful quote from Ajahn Chah, my teacher, Jack's teacher in the Thai forest. If you let go a little, you have a little peace. If you let go a lot, you find a lot of peace. If you let go completely, you find complete peace. What might it even mean to let go that completely? I think it means that just as letting go a little comes with a kind of independence from the senses, letting go completely comes as a kind of independence from everything. The heart can relax, not dependent on anyone else for its well-being. That doesn't mean we don't connect with others or we aren't dependent on others for all sorts of good things in the material and emotional world. It means we're not dependent on others for wisdom. And in a way, it means that we ourselves have arrived at elderhood. It's not random that this tradition, the Theravada tradition, insight meditation was born out of the Theravada tradition. Theravada means the way of the elders. So the Thera are the ones that have achieved elderhood. I think elderhood is achieved by any human or animal or spirit being who understands enough to be a refuge and a guide for others, to be a good friend in the Sangha, to be reliable and trustworthy, one who you can trust ethically and who can be a good guide in the Dhamma. And so attaining that, and that really means, to go back to the beginning of the talk, stream entry, that really means that the elder is one who has seen enough to be able to let go some amount. Maybe they're not finished yet. Most of us aren't finished yet. But has seen enough to be trustworthy as a guide so that you can attain the same elderhood. From there, once one is independent, and all the way along the path toward this deep independence, there's a kind of power that comes. And that power, I think, is not different from maturity, from deep maturity, but it's a power that comes when we can be with the culture around us and the people around us and the dramas around us without being pulled under by them. And that means that our participation is cleaner, I think more creative, more compassionate, more choiceful. To be not independent, I think, mostly means to not really be choosing how we engage, but to be engaging out of force of habit and a conditioning. To be independent means I can really choose how I engage. And I'm going to choose as well as I can. I'm going to choose love. I'm going to choose kindness. Right? Maybe I choose a very vigorous rebellion, supporting the oppressed at times. And other times I choose to rest back and participate in a different way through teaching, through study, through retreat. One of my teachers, who was very active in recent civil rights processes for the last 20, 30 years, deeply involved in civil rights movements, said upon the election of the last administration, the Trump administration, said that and that she could see what the next phase in American political life might look like, given the ascendancy of the right. And she said that that what was right for her to do was to, in a sense, sit this one out. So to after a lifetime of of strong struggle and lots of progress, now to take a moment and sit back and write and study and focus on practice in other ways, that the fight would be different in this era. And so engagement comes in all sorts of different forms. But choosing how you engage is only possible when there is some amount of this kind of independence. So to end, I'm going to read you a couple short quotes from some texts that describe this, this freedom or this independence that's possible. The first I'll read is a couple of similes from the description of liberation, of the deep insights. When the Buddha describes his liberation, his attainment of knowledge, he describes having three insights: an insight into his own past lives, an insight into how other people are born and die and are reborn in accordance with their actions, and an insight into the uprooting of the defilements and the attainment of freedom through deep letting go. And he gives metaphors for these, similes for these, that paint a picture in a way of what this liberated perspective is like. So the first one is the insight into one's own previous births. And he describes it like this. Suppose a person was to leave their home village and go to another village. From that village, they'd go to yet another village. And from that village, they'd return to their home village. And they'd think, I went from my home village to another village. There, I stood like this, sat like this, spoke like this, or kept silent like that. Et cetera, et cetera. So the first insight is really just clear memory. I remember what I did. I went there. I came back. This is what I did while I was there. The second insight into seeing other people, how other people appear and disappear, are born and pass away in accordance with their actions. The Buddha says this. Suppose there was a stilt longhouse at the central square. A person with clear eyes standing there might see people entering and leaving a house, walking along the streets and paths, and sitting at the central square. And they'd think, these are people entering and leaving a house, walking along the streets and paths, and sitting at the central square. So the second insight, this is the clairvoyance insight, seeing other people appear and disappear as in accord with their actions, is like having a perch by which you can see everybody coming and going. Again, it's very straightforward. You can just see people left here, went here, did this. So there's an observation. And, you know, both of these insights, memory of one's own movements and then seeing other people's movements, the way they're described here, you can tell that there's a kind of emotional spaciousness, right? It's not describing, I saw a person exit their house and have a ferocious argument, and I got really interested in that argument. So I jumped down out of the stilt longhouse and I went over to get involved because I knew those people. And I, you know, it's not involved in that way. It's just like, I saw this happen. And the third and last of the insights, the ending of the defilements, the simile is this. Suppose that in a mountain glen, there was a lake that was transparent, clear, and unclouded. A person with clear eyes standing on the bank would see the clams and mussels and pebbles and gravel and schools of fish swimming about or staying still. And so, again, there's a bit of distance and there's observation. And in this case, there's a little bit more distance, right? It's a person looking at an underwater ecosystem. And I think that's important here. There's really a kind of independence of that observer from that ecosystem. And again, they're not fishing. They're not dumping trash in the pond. They're just observing. There's a kind of naturalist stance here right? And if you've ever been in a naturalist or known naturalists, so much of what the naturalist does is to just sit and observe, right? You have a spot and you sit and you watch and you observe. And only by observing over time can you really understand the ecosystem that you're seeing. Understanding it, you love it. Loving it, you act to protect it. I think this is fairly straightforward. And we see it all over. Whenever anyone invests themselves deeply enough in a social system or a natural ecosystem, a political ecosystem, enough to see it clearly, there's a kind of love and respect there. And then the engagement that they do is to protect, you know, is to try to ease suffering, to protect beings from suffering. So our instruction is to observe the world, starting with our own senses and our body, and moving outward from there to observe others and their comings and goings, and how action always has impacts, leads to results, and how that changes people. And observing all of that, we come to respect and to love. And then we come to elderhood, where there's enough of a perspective that we might be able to see what could really help here. And what helps is many things, material and immaterial. But we begin to live in such a way that our own heart's arrival at peace doesn't take anything away from anyone else. We don't need any particular resources or wealth to rest in this freedom, because it's a freedom born of clear seeing, not of gain. And so our independence is not at the cost of anyone else's independence. Our independence is an arrival in the stream of truth. And from arriving in that stream, we can then choose how we meet all those around us. And the natural response is with love and compassion, and the urge to express what we know is true in the world. And we've arrived at being independent from others in the teacher's dispensation. We've arrived at freedom. And of course, we arrive at it gradually over time, in deepening and deepening circles. All right, so we'll leave it there. Thank you for your warm attention. And we have some time for questions about practice, reflections, responses. You can raise your electronic hand, which is under the reactions tab on your screen, and I'll call on folks, and then Ileana will unmute you. And you can speak. You can also drop questions into the chat, and I'll read them aloud. Or you can send questions to Ileana in the chat and she'll read them aloud. Hi, Valerie, please.
Oh, thank you. Can you hear me?
Yes.
Oh, good. I don't even begin to know how to say what I want to say, other than the first line that I heard from you and actually heard and felt was, impermanence is the fragrance of our life. And I want to thank you for that. Had some powerful happenings to me today, a loss of someone I knew. And so it was very impactful, and I want to thank you for that. And thank you for your talk. Again, it also was inspiring. So, metta to you and to all who suffer.
Thank you. Thank you. Condolences for your loss.
Thank you.
Yes. The line that I think it is the impermanence that haunts our days is their very fragrance. It's from Joanna Macy and Anita Barrow's translation of Rainier Maria Rilke's Sonnets of Orpheus, the beautiful Buddhist-influenced translation of that gorgeous text. Reflection coming through in the chat. So is there something here about achieving independence of insight that then allows for the deepest experience of interdependence? Is it that that independence is a necessary factor for understanding interconnectedness? Yeah, I wondered if I would get to interdependence. I think we stayed with independence tonight. Interdependence is a complex term that in the earliest layer of the Buddha's teachings, in the Pali Canon, generally arises in relation to a diagram that explains the process of existence, sensory contact, clinging, and further becoming. Called the Wheel of Dependent Origination, or Paticca Samuppada. And sometimes that's called dependent arising or interdependent arising. Interdependence grew from that initial teaching, which is really a description of how suffering comes to be, how consciousness is connected to sensations, which is connected to feeling, which is connected to action. It grew in the Mahayana and the later traditions into a recognition that understanding impermanence could naturally blossom into a sense of how everything is connected. Because if we were actually disconnected, if there were any part of us, here's the philosophical logic to this. If this gets your brain in a tangle, just let it go. The philosophical logic is, if there were part of us that were truly individual or separate from anything else, like if we had an individual essence, a soul, that thing by necessity would have to not change. Because if it changes, it can't be one thing, right? And things don't change other than by it being influenced by something else. So if something was a universal constant, like a soul or God for that matter, it would by definition not change. If it by definition didn't change, it could neither suffer nor be liberated. And it can't be found. So if you investigate your experience, because you're trying to understand suffering, you can't find anything that is like this, permanent, unchanging individual. So then the philosopher said, if that's true, and that seems to be true, then everything must be connected to everything else. Because the only way something could be disconnected, in other words, not make contact with the world, is if it was a universal permanent constant. And so if you had a soul, it would by definition not be able to make contact with the world, because contact changes things. And if it was unchangeable, it can't make contact. Right? And so from there, there developed the beautiful unfolding of the Dharma in the direction of the recognition of interconnectedness or interdependence. So impermanence implies emptiness, which implies interdependence. Everything is tied together because nothing is separate, because everything constantly changes. Those things all together become this interwoven insight. And so some of the later traditions really pick up on that. You can come in through, in a certain way, the back door. Like you can come in through impermanence. You see everything change and you let go. You can also come in through seeing interdependence, seeing how everything is connected to everything else. You let go because there's nothing actually separate to cling to. And so then those become really interwoven. And so I think different personalities enter through different doorways there. Some people enter through the doorway of emptiness. Some people enter through the doorway of fullness. That's one way to think about it. But I think if the insight is clear, they connect, right? You can get lost in one or the other. If you get lost in emptiness and you forget interconnectedness, you can go kind of nihilistic. You can just hang out with the insight that nothing really has meaning. And that only goes halfway, right? It's hard to get all the way to love and compassion and freedom if you get stuck on meaninglessness. Likewise, if you go in through the doorway of fullness, you can get stuck on the sort of vast pulsing eros of the cosmos, where everything is a pulsing, sensual, interconnected weave of magnificent, luminous aliveness. That's cool. That's also true. But you can get hung up on that as a thing to cling to. And then you're clinging to experiences of fullness. And it can be hard to let go. And so when those things meet, and there's a profound realization of impermanence that leads to letting go, there can, and but there's also an appreciation that that means that the fullness is universal, that it doesn't, that nothing is excluded from fullness. Then those two things meeting, that's really nice, right? That's a kind of integrated wisdom, because it neither grasps nor pushes away, right? Even at these very subtle insights at the heart of the path. So there's a bit about how those come together. Yeah, Shakti, please.
Yeah, that was a really beautiful or insightful, and I mean, these are concepts that have been kind of grappling with myself, because I actually practice both with insight and Zen communities. Mm-hmm. And I'm also very much looking at how we connect to the rest of the living world or non-living world or all the, 'cause I think you were touching on, you know, some of the environmental kind of interactions that, and how that, we, you know, we're not apart from our environment either. You know, there's this like weaving together that I've been trying to grapple with, and I really appreciate the depth with which you just like kind of made this crazy puzzle start to put the pieces in their own way that I'm starting to grapple with. And so I just wanted to let you know that you're like, you're talking about wisdom as being sort of this something we have wisdom, like without doing all of the, you know, reading and writing and all of this stuff, but maybe just having wisdom of some sort. And I almost feel like there was part of you, I know you're very educated with all of this reading and your references in the, and also with, you know, what the Buddha was saying, but this kind of like, can we connect to this wisdom, you know, of that, you know, emptiness and interconnection. And I think that as a society, it's, you know, it's hard because I feel like we've lost that so much, you know, and just the whole way, you know, going way back in history, you know, it's been a kind of frightening how, you know, like you were saying with Australia and all of the extinction of some fabulous creature because there's this like othering of, you know, and this like, I'm going to get as much as I can out of this and then move on. You know, I don't know. I'm kind of rambling, but I really appreciate all those connections and just wanted to let you know. So I don't know if there's really much of a question in there, more of a, just a, yeah, just a really appreciating this.
Thank you. Yeah. Yeah. Thank you. Blessings in your path and lineage. One of the things I appreciate the most about the early Buddhist system is that the texts are certainly, there's tons of them. First of all, it's a very large sacred body of sacred texts, different from some of the like the Western traditions, the Christian tradition, the Islamic tradition, the Jewish tradition, where the fundamental texts are these shorter, you know, sacred books. What we really have in the Buddhist tradition is the record of a person's and a community's teaching over the course of you know, several decades of well-recorded, well-remembered teachings. And so it's quite diverse what you find in there. And there's encouragement for, you know, quite a rich phenomenological, you know, exploratory practice. It's an extraordinary body of instructional text. And so one of the reasons I appreciate this most is because the core insight that it's pointing to is actually quite difficult to come by on our own. It's actually difficult to realize what is going on through our deepest habits and you know, cultural ideas, fixated ideas. It's really hard to realize something by yourself, as it turns out, you know. And why should we have to? Like, the whole point of having a Buddha and having a tradition is that someone figured something out, planted the seed of it, and then thousands and thousands of people devoted their entire lives to confirming that, challenging it, developing it, writing it down, preserving it, transmitting it, enriching it. And this is one of the bodies of wisdom, knowledge, one of the most extraordinary bodies of wisdom, knowledge in the history of humans on this planet. There's a few really amazing bodies of cultural knowledge. There's several, really. This is one of them. And it's a really good one. And so I think I very much don't believe that I could come upon, you know, the wisdom into emptiness or fullness or impermanence or the deep dharmas on my own. But why should I? I have the blessing to be born in an era where the dharma is available. And that's considered one of the greatest blessings. It's not always the case. You could be born in a time or a place where there's no dharma. It happens all the time. You know, Buddhas are not that common, as it turns out. And there will be a time, the texts tell us, when this when these teachings fade away, and they're hard to find. And so there's a beautiful weave between study and discussion and finding good teachers and the wisdom that then arises for ourselves, leading to independence. You can't do it alone. You can't get there alone. But once you get there, you have a power that can't be shaken or taken away by anyone else. And that's what we're talking about with independence. And those folks become elders. They become teachers and guides that can be trusted. And then the whole, and then the wheel rolls forward for one more generation. And all you can do is your generation, right? And if your generation, our generation, if we drop it, it stops. The wheel stops rolling if any one generation forgets how to find freedom. And so it's on us. It's on those who have faith. If that's you, I don't know if that's you, but if it's you, it's partly on us and our communities to do this. And so then that's part of the joy of study and discussion and sharing and practice, that it's never for ourselves alone. All right, so we are at our time and a teeny bit beyond. Thank you for your devotion to the Dhamma, for your devotion to liberation, whatever that is for you. Gratitude to those who have held and tended this tradition for all of its millennia, from the speaking of the words originally, through memorizing, through writing, through study, and through the long, strange transmission of the colonial years to bring these teachings to my ears and to yours. May we each be blessed with insight, determination, and the good luck and health and safety to be able to practice. And may our lives be an inspiration and a force of goodness in the world. May all beings know the deep truth of the way, and may all the wars end, inner and outer. All right. Blessings to you each. Thank you for your generosity in supporting Spirit Rock and our teaching in the world. And I hope to see you sometime soon. You can find me at my website. And if you want to study these texts with me, I've just started a book club reading the long discourses of the Buddha once a month, Friday mornings. And we're reading the Digha Nikaya, from which I quoted a little bit tonight. So come and join me in Sutta study. Or there's a Tuesday evening sitting group, that kind of thing, both online. And I'll see you soon. Be good care. Thank you, Ileana, for your support tonight.
Thank you for listening. To learn how you can support the teachers and Dharma Seed, please visit dharmaseed.org/donate.